Madeleine Parent has been walking picket lines for nearly 70 years. She organized textile workers in Quebec in the 1940s, led numerous other union drives in mines and mills, launched the Confederation of Canadian Unions in the 1960s, and she continues to be active in feminist and anti-imperialist struggles. Throughout all of this, she's been an inspiration for generations of organizers and activists. The book Madeleine Parent, Activist, is a collection of essays on Madeleine's contributions, and it was published by Sumac Press earlier this year. In one essay, Françoise David writes that Madeleine is our collective conscience, an indefatigable militant she has been and is part of every struggle. Madeleine Parent has joined us this morning from her home in Montreal. Good morning, Madeleine, and welcome to Red Eye.
Good morning, Lisa.
You were hired for your first union job as a union organizer shortly after you graduated from university in 1940. At the time, was that an unusual career choice for a woman with a university degree?
Yes, most unusual. I decided that a few months before graduation and kept it a deep, dark secret because people would have thought I was crazy. They tried to direct me in various other endeavors, and I always refused. And in fact, I taught classes to workers through the Workers' Educational Association after graduation, but I got a full-time job in the war labor organizing campaign of the AFL unions in Quebec in May 1942, and carried on from there.
And what led you to work in the textile mills? I understand that those were some of your first organizing campaigns.
Well, in those days, there were a lot of cotton mills in Quebec. That is, where you receive the cotton bales from a southern country, tear them apart, card, spin, weave, inspect, and finish. And they were huge mills, and they employed a lot of women and also children. And they were centers of exploitation everywhere in Quebec. There was a great need, and I was very much attracted to the idea of organizing where there were so many women having a tough time and being abused, and children as well. Now, Kent Rowley came to our organizing committee in 42 and offered to organize, and the other members of the committee had ideas. They insisted he organize in the war industries. So after refusing to do that and insisting on the cotton mills, he took an understanding with them that if they would let him organize in a war plant in Valleyfield, he made sure that they had no objection about his choices on his free time, then he was hired, and on his free time he visited cotton mill workers, and that's how it started.
And when you started visiting cotton mill workers with him and on your own, what were some of the conditions that you found for women and children in the mills?
In those days, the women worked 10 hours a day, and since it was wartime, 10 hours at night. The men worked 11 hours or so, and this was 5.5 days a week. On Saturdays, they worked 5 hours. There were no paid holidays. The wages were exceedingly low, and nearly all the women were on piecework. So by driving them to work as hard and as fast as they could, the women were the ones who set the pace of production in the mills, and it was a very hard life for them. Many of them lost their coloring by loss of blood, anemia, in the course of years, And the bosses were very, very difficult and very demanding. And the women also had problems with sexual harassment. So there was a lot to do. And one has to realize that the children were, of course, the object of harassment, and were pushed and driven. And it was the women who would rescue them in the plant, who would look after them, warn them about dangers of accidents, because if a child saw a thread going up, breaking and going up towards the ceiling, he would be inclined to climb on the frame and go for it. And of course the women would stop them and tell them the frame has to be stopped before anybody puts foot on it. But especially they rescued them from the harassment and the driving of the foreman, and the children appreciated it, as we could tell in organizing. They followed the women into the union, and they voted as the women voted, which is very contrary to what some of the trade unionists would tell us. You can't organize plants with women and children. Well, we did, but it was thanks to the women that we were able to achieve that.
As you said, the union bureaucracy of at the time said that women and children would never be able to organize, yet obviously with your leadership and with a different approach, they did. How was women's organizing in the mills different from the model that some of the male union leaders might have envisioned?
Well, in the first place, the AFL unions had mostly English-speaking union top leaders. They had other leaders, usually less with less authority, who spoke French. But the very fact that they themselves, the main leaders in each sector, didn't speak French, created a distance between them and the members. And they didn't really know how the members worked and how they were pushed around. So that wasn't very helpful. Besides, there was quite a bit of bureaucracy, not in all of the AFL unions, but in a considerable number of them, including the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, after my friend Leah Roback had to leave, although she had led the successful strike in 1937. So they were the fact that they didn't speak the language made them even more bureaucratic and subject to the bosses of labor in Washington, New York, Chicago, or elsewhere. And for me, and for Kent Rowley, and for a number of us, we would not join the Catholic syndicates at that time, because they had they were subject to the influence of the Catholic Church, and we believed in the division between church and state, and we would not give up the freedom of workers to organize to any other authority. Today, there's no Catholic syndicates. It's a confederation of national unions, which is a good, militant, well-organized union, but of course we didn't have that choice way back in 1942.
In addition to confronting the company then, did women in the cotton mills also have to confront other paternalistic elements in their own communities from the church and other sectors of the community?
Oh, absolutely. For one thing, you know, the women of Quebec only got the right to vote in 1940 under the Liberal government of Adélard Godbout, who was a good government leader. But the Catholic Church clergy had opposed the vote for women constantly, and to the extent that at their Sunday sermons and in their visits in the homes, in the parishes, they would say that women should not belong to a political party and should not vote, because what would happen if they were voted against their own husband? This would divide. So we were supposed to be obedient, both to the church and to a husband or a father. Now, we didn't accept that. And, of course, eventually, with the Quiet Revolution, after Du Plessis's death, and starting out with the 1960 election of the Lesage government in Quebec, where René Lévesque was a key minister, and a few others were excellent. With the Quiet Revolution, women made a lot of progress, and laws were changed. But today, again, some of these gains are being taken away from us with the liberal Charest government and our own Margaret Thatcher.
And thinking back again to your work in the Dominion textile mills, mm-hmm. the strike in 1946 is seen as a real turning point for women workers mm-hmm. in the mills. Why was that?
Well, in 1937, the Catholic syndicates had launched a strike in the cotton mills, not with very much consultation amongst the workers. Many arrived on the morning of the strike to go to work, and they didn't know what was going on because there were picket lines. And unfortunately, after 3 weeks of strike or so, Maurice Duplessis plus the head bishop, the cardinal of Quebec, plus the Quebec member of parliament, who was a Duplessis man, ordered the workers back to work on false promises. They had won nothing, and they went back to work, and there was nothing. So we came 5 years after, and they wanted to be sure they didn't have a Catholic union or a union that was subject to the bishop. And though I must say the bishop tried and ran as much competition to us as possible, but he didn't succeed. And it was like a liberation. These mills had been built in the previous century, and time and again workers tried to protest and organize, and they were beaten back, and they had never got a union contract. And now that we had taken 4 years just to get those mills organized and have them certified by the government, and gone through all the proceedings in 4 years, this was the day, the 1st of June 1946, and it was like a liberation. The people knew they had to stick together, and the women knew that for them, jobs for women were low paid anyway, in whatever field. And since they were organized and out to fight properly, they were not going to give up, no matter what. So it was very good. They had confidence. And I must say, the president of our union in Valleyfield had been vice president of the Catholic syndicates in their 37 strike, and he was the only outstanding person who had tried to warn the workers not to listen to Duplessis and the bishops and stick it out. But the pressure was too hard on them. Now, this man who had a clean record and was respected by the workers was their leader locally. And Kent Rowley and I and others, we felt strong. We knew the obstacles would be horrible. Kent Rowley spent the last 3 weeks of the Valley Field strike in jail, and there was a warrant out for me, but with very skillful lawyers, we beat them at it, and I was able to remain out for the day of a vote, which the government had planned to falsify, expecting that both Kent and I would be in jail. So there were lots of difficulties, lots of obstacles, but the feeling of the workers was so strong that we won out finally.
And in addition to the collective advances that were won, how do you think this victory impacted the individual women who were on the picket lines?
Oh, they were very strong. You know, in Valley Field, which is a smaller town, at every Sunday Mass, the bishop of the cathedral plus the parish priests in the three other parishes made their sermon against the union and against us personally. And we had the habit, not every Sunday night, but on several Sunday nights, to have a meeting. And I had urged the members to make sure their wives were invited. So they would come to the Sunday night meeting, and that was above City Hall, but we had a wonderful technician with loudspeakers who supported our union, and he had the speeches of the union out on the loudspeakers on the marketplace, plus down in a park nearby, so you'd have about 3,000 people listening to the speeches. And it was Trefli Ludzik, who always went to Mass, who would say, "Go to the church for your soul, to save your soul, and come to the union to save your stomachs." Which was a good people's way of expressing the division and the freedom that workers have to give themselves. The women were magnificent. The wives and mothers had set up a ladies' auxiliary, and this was not a tea party kind of thing. They'd go to visit the farmers on market day and get support, get vegetables, get fruit, get whatever they had to give. They would go to visit proprietors whose workers may not be able to pay their rent as they always did before, and ask them to give them credit until after the strike. And if they had any trouble, they'd warn them, "We will remember you when the strike is over." So they were really heroic. And it meant that the families were more united. And the women at home would put a little bit more water in the stew or the soup and support the strike just as strongly as their husbands or sons and daughters did. So you had magnificent unity there. And that's what won us the strike in the end, of course.
Then much of your work from the early 1950s on focused on creating a truly militant and independent Canadian labor movement that couldn't be controlled by U.S. centrals. Why was that so important at the time?
Well, for one thing, we never wanted to join an American union. We would have preferred a Canadian union that was also free of the church originally, but we had no choice. And the leaders of our union in Washington were very, very backward, and the company knew they could buy them off. And in fact, in 1952, they bought them off, and they fired us without consulting with the Canadian workers. And they were caught up by the Senate committee that Bobby Kennedy chaired a few years after our strike, but it was too late for us, and they had to get out of the trade union movement for corruption. They had stolen the union treasury as well, and with that built a couple of houses for themselves and their families in Virginia, and said the record, they received money from a Canadian employer in 52, which was our second strike. So we knew very well that came from the Dominion Textile Company. They didn't have to tell us. But they were never militants. It was just that we were not in a position at the age of 23 or 24 to start a whole new Canadian movement. We had to join somewhere, and in fact we had some colleagues in some of the unions who were honest and fighting, so we had no choice. But when they sold us out completely, as they did, and their position was, you sign the contract that the company has put on the table or else. And that contract that the company insisted on took away all the rights we had won over the years, seniority rights, various women's rights, the right to grieve, and made even the wages, since there was piecework, quite you know, you couldn't set up standards and hold to them because the company had total management's rights over the plant. So we explained all of this to the workers, and they agreed with us that we couldn't accept and we had to fight. But it was later in 52 that we started all over again, a little bit wiser, but with workers in our contract plants in Ontario, and you know, who hadn't been burned by the horrible battle which Duplessis and the Bishop had imposed upon us in Quebec. And so we started over again with the modest Canadian Union, and that was pretty hard, but it worked until the United Automobile Workers, affiliated with their Detroit head office, decided themselves to go Canadian because they were being used by the American Union against their own Canadian unionist interests. And then, of course, at that stage, we affiliated with them. But by then, Kent had died.
And what has been the legacy, then, of the Confederation of Canadian Unions? Things have obviously changed a lot since those days.
The legacy is that our members pointed the way, which was Canadian independence for Canadian workers. We had exposed the fact that, and these figures were published by the Canadian government, which surely didn't do it for the purpose that it was used. We had, with government figures, we had exposed the fact that American unions every year collected more dues from the Canadian workers than the amount of money they sent back, even in the years where there were several strikes. They always made a profit out of us. So we were not that weak, and we were not that poor, and not that incapable that we couldn't run our own affairs, make our own decisions, and the workers in Canada alone elect their own leaders. So we prepared the way with the Confederation of Canadian Unions and helped to build the feeling that Canadian workers could do their own work. We had always somehow had the feeling of the colonists' feeling that, first of all, you depended on Great Britain, later you depended on the United States of America, and we were never ourselves. But we had to fight our own battles, and the figures we used from Ottawa, which were quite official, demonstrated that we did fight our own battles, but we paid extra money to carry the American flag, which was of no use to us at all and meant that we suffered many betrayals in the course of our organization work. So I think we pointed the way, and we can be proud of that, and proud that the CAW was willing to take up the cause at one point on the basis of their own experience with the American Union, which was not as militant as theirs was here.
In the book, Madeleine Perron, Activist, you're quoted as saying, every labor battle teaches a worker how to fight. Nothing is ever completely lost. So what lessons do you think we learn from organizing, regardless of whether or not we're successful in the end?
Yeah. You see, first of all, when we lose a strike technically, we must not abandon the workers. We must stay with them if it's not possible to rebuild that particular local union as they would like to, at least stay with them, absorb the lessons on what we learned in the course of our struggles, what we won, and help them to maintain a sense that they have power if they want to use it. There can be good times, there can be bad times, but if they stick together enough, there will be other good times again. And if they're not there to seize the opportunity, it will be lost. And, you know, one of the most satisfying things to me as an individual and as a woman is when I would see women who worked in fear of the boss, in fear that the company would get them fired, in fear that if they refused, even in the case of sexual harassment, they might be fired, or at least given the worst job in the plant. And then learning through the union that there's such a thing as laws and human rights, but they don't operate unless we organize together and claim those rights. And then when they discover they're human beings and have rights, it changes their lives. And I remember in one case where we decided that a particular move would be too much and we would lose, and people were very downcast. And one woman spoke up and said, "Well, I'm glad we fought. There's something that I learned in the struggle that they'll never take away from me. Before the union came, when I'd go to work every morning, I'd go with a heavy heart, fearful that I'd be fired or given the worst work in the department. But now they can't do that to me anymore, because I know I'm a person with rights." And it encouraged the others as well, you know.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning, Madeleine. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Well, thank you very much, Lisa. It was good talking with you, too.
I've been speaking with Madeleine Perrant, who joined us this morning on the phone from her home in Montreal. The book Madeleine Perrant, Activist, was edited by André Levesque and published earlier this year by Sumac Press. You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.